the foolish old man who removed the mountains. I'm sure you know about that. It's only a fairy story. It's not true. About an old peasant who lived in a village where the scenery was very nice, but just outside his cottage there was a big mountain which blocked out the view. And one day he climbed up the mountain with his hoe, and somebody saw him doing so and said, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm removing the mountain so that I can appreciate the scene." And they said, "Well, don't be an old fool, you'll never move that." He said, "Well, maybe I won't, but when I'm dead, my sons will carry on, and when they're dead, their sons will carry on. And one thing is sure, the mountain can never get any higher, it can only get lower." Now, this was told by Mao to the Chinese people at a time when they were facing enormous difficulties, fantastic problems with the Japanese, their three-all policy, burn all, loot all, kill all, fantastic problems. And it inspired them, it became a material force, as the book says, you see, became a material force which enabled them to overcome bigger mountains than this one that was blocking the view. But the idea that I really want to come to is what this reporter was saying about all the ideas out of Mao's head being a guide for everybody. Well, where do how do the ideas get into Mao's head? That's the point. You see, Mao himself has written about this. He's written an article about where do correct ideas come from, and that applies to his ideas as well. And he says straight away, they don't drop out of the heavens. Now, Mao's ideas, Mao's teachings, Mao's politics, come from Mao's analysis and synthesis of the experiences of hundreds of millions of Chinese working people in the course of changing society over the past several hundred years. That Mao's not created this, they have created it, the people have created it. What Mao has done, and it takes a genius to do so, is to absorb it, study it, analyze it, synthesize it, refine it, and give it back to the people. That's what he's done. Moreover, not only the Chinese people, because what Mao has done, Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin did before. But he has used their own analysis, their own refinement of the experience of the working masses, and brought it right up to the 20th century, right up to the 20th century, specifically in the People's Republic of China, where the new man is being created. Well, now in the course of a newspaper interview or television interview, it's a bit difficult to put it across, but I do feel that it's an awful shame, in a sense, that the so many American people have had this kind of talk handed down to them, you know, about one man's ideas governing everything you do in life, whether it's reattaching fingers or growing rice. Well, anyhow, it is politics, the success that they've enjoyed in reattaching severed limbs, and I can assure you that the results are extraordinarily gratifying, and as well as being very, very interesting and important in the technical, professional point of view, as I say, within the field of surgery. Only yesterday or the day before, I don't know, when I was in Boston, I suppose it was only yesterday, I gave a report on this at one of the Harvard Medical College hospitals, and showed it illustrated by slides, and again, there was a lot of interest and understanding and appreciation that this was really a big advance in medicine. And it was an advance in medicine which had been inspired by and which rested upon the politics of the country. Now, I'd like to leave the sort of inner medical professional part of it, because I think that most of you are not in the medical profession. And I just like to talk about the kind of relationships that you find in hospitals. I mentioned before that it's considered wrong for there to be a difference in status of privilege between mental workers and manual workers. Also between different levels, different grades of either of them. there's an attempt to break down a hierarchy, the hierarchical system which exists in many institutions all over the world, is being systematically demolished in China. For example, the wards in the hospital where I worked are run by committees of three people. One is a nurse, one is a doctor, one's an orderly. They all serve the people, they all serve the patients, they do it according to the best of their abilities, which depends upon the kind of past and education training they've had. They meet together every day and they review the previous day's work and they plan the next day's work. If an operation is planned in the ward, a big operation, a potentially dangerous operation, that too is discussed by everybody in the ward, including the patients. In the hospital at large, the hospital administrator used to do one day a week manual work either in the garden or in the laundry or in the boiler house or what have you. Because it's believed in China that if you sit on your backside in an office with a lot of telephones and you issue orders, you become a bureaucrat. And it doesn't matter how good you are at heart, you know, how red you are and how firmly you're convinced you are of socialist principles, if that's what you do, if you sit in your backside and issue orders, you become a bureaucrat in any country in the world. And one of the ways, and not the only way, and maybe not the most important way, but one of the ways of overcoming this is to go and do the job yourself. And so when our hospital director used to go and work in the boiler house, he did so not to teach the boiler man how to stoke the boiler, but to learn from him how to stoke the boiler. Because another thing that Chairman Mao says is this: before you can be a teacher of the masses, you've got to be a pupil of the masses. And he uses not the Chinese word for student, but pupil, which is, you know, a very little kind of, very young kind of student. You've got to be humble about it. You've got to be prepared to learn before you can teach. And that applies all the way through. It applies especially to teachers. They've got to listen to their students and learn from their students before they can really teach them. And so there was a consistent attempt to break down the barriers in the hospital. For example, we all had our lunch together. Great big dining room, much higher than this, not quite as wide. 900 of us used to eat lunch together every day. Porters, boilermen, doctors, everybody together. Lunch cost about 5 cents. And while it wasn't very fancy, it was very well cooked, very nice, and plenty of it. Whenever there was anything on in the locality that needed the participation of intellectuals, such as harvest time. The wheat harvest in Peking comes in with a rush in June. Well, we all used to go out and do our bit. Well, quite early on, soon after I got to China, they started building a dam out on the outskirts of Peking, near the Ming tombs, where the Ming emperors are buried. They wanted to control a river and generate some electricity in the course of doing so. And so they built a dam by voluntary labor, the voluntary labor of the Peking people, especially the Peking intellectuals. So we all went along. I did my little bit. My wife was there for 3 or 4 weeks. Chairman Mao did his bit, Joe and I, everybody contributed a bit. Now, this dam is completed, long since completed, and it's in a very nice part of Peking, nice countryside around there. People like to go out there for a picnic at the weekends. And whenever I went there afterwards and I see this dam, oh, big dam with cars going over it, I would always think, well, inside there's a little bit of my sweat. Inside there's a few feet of earth that I removed, a few pounds of stones that I carried. And that's what everybody feels. They feel, this is our dam. We built it. It belongs to us. We're part of the people. This is to serve the people. This is the way in which the gap between these intellectual workers and the ordinary people of the country is consistently being broken down. I don't want to give an exaggerated idea. I don't want to say there's no difference in China between mental and manual work, between worker and peasant. In town and country. There is a difference, even quite a big difference. The point is, what's happening to the difference? Is it getting bigger or smaller? And the answer is, it's getting smaller. And it's getting smaller in some sectors very, very rapidly. Of course, the hospital, I've been speaking about the hospital, the relationships in it. But the hospital is not only concerned with treating sickness, it's primarily concerned with preventing disease. And so the hospital is in a locality, and my hospital was responsible for the health of about 70, 80,000 people living in the northwestern corner of Peking. And we had teams of doctors, nurses, laboratory workers who used to go out and visit the people in their houses, see what their living conditions were, what the sanitary conditions were like, so on and so forth, carry out inoculations of the children against poliomyelitis, whooping cough, diphtheria, so on and so forth, antenatal examinations, generally be of service to the looking after the health of the people. And then again, if they were ever called out at night and a patient in the locality couldn't come into hospital, it's perfectly all right to telephone the hospital and somebody will go out, see the patient at home. So the hospital was sort of a community hospital. It was a regular standard municipal hospital where I was working, and this was part of the overall community and concerned with safeguarding the health of the Chinese people. Thank you.
That was a talk by Dr. Joshua Horn, recorded in New York on April 21st. Dr. Horn is a British surgeon who left England in 1954 and spent 15 years in the People's Republic of China. This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM.
Next, we hear the political economy of the Chinese Revolution, a speech by William Hinton delivered in New York on April 1, 1971. Mr. Hinton discusses economic changes in China, including land reform and its five stages. But his primary concern is the political philosophy, which is the foundation for economic change.
Lin Biao had summed up the question of politics with four phrases, the four firsts. He summed it up in essence in regard to the military, but it applies throughout society. As between men and weapons, one must put man in first place. And as between politics and other problems that men face, one puts politics in first place. And as between ordinary political problems and the problems of ideology and political consciousness, one has to put political consciousness and ideology first. And as between the living ideas in people's heads and ideas in books, one has to put the living ideas first. And these are the sort of the summation of the experience of the revolution in China in regard to politics in command. Now, if you think through these four things and look at those two armed forces that clashed in the last few weeks, you can see the truth of this summation. Now, in regard to the economic development of China, this question of technique in command versus politics in command came up in my life experience very early. I remember during some examples from World War II, I was in Southwest China during the war, and I worked in a part of the U.S. government service with a man named Gerald Winfield, who was a lively old missionary who had all sorts of solutions for China, all of which were technical. He was a very keen propagandist, and he used to lecture to us. We were all young neophytes, and he was the old China hand, and he used to lecture to us all about what China needed. And in his view, of course, what China needed was fertilizer, insecticides, tractors, electric power, irrigation pumps, science, biology, chemistry, and so on. And that had been his whole work. Actually, I guess professionally, he was a parasitologist. Of course, he himself, of course, was a parasite, but that isn't what I meant. He had a regular paradise for parasitology out in West China. But of course, all these efforts to modernize China fell afoul of the old society. The semi-feudal colonial economy of China, the political economy of China, was such that there was really no way that anyone could modernize it. Certainly not without basic changes. And all these Western experts came in with the idea that of modernization. They were going to bring science and all these changes and lift China out of the feudalism. But the only techniques they knew, the economic techniques and the scientific techniques, all had to do with capitalism, with the investment of capital, with a commodity market, with loans and credit and interest and so on. And they came into a country where throughout the hinterland there wasn't much of a commodity market, if any commodity market at all. And money wasn't capital in the Chinese hinterland. There was no one who thought in terms of money as an investment. There was no safe way that money could be invested in production. Money was used to buy land. Money was turned into gold and buried in the ground. Money was loaned out to indigent people who either were sick or didn't have enough grain to live till spring and so on. And it was returned at 100% interest, 200% interest, 300% interest. But none of these forms in any way aided production. It is of no use to bid up the price of land. The land doesn't change one iota from the fact that it was once worth $100 an acre and is now, say, $200 an acre. It didn't make it any more productive. All it implied was that more people were bidding for it. When you loan money to someone who is either because they're sick or they can't live through till spring, and you get 200% back, it is really just, you might say it aids production in that it kept a potential producer alive, but of course such a loan did not in any way advance production in any ordinary sense. When you take money and convert it into silver and gold and bury it in the ground, that doesn't aid production either. That simply takes potential capital and turns it into something other than capital, simply inert wealth. And throughout China, throughout the economy of China, where you didn't have capitalist society, you had a semi-feudal, semi-colonial society, all these plans for modernization broke on this rock. So that you had a stagnant situation in which not only was production not developing, but production was actually declining. There was enough of a commodity market so that Western textiles, for instance, flooded China and broke up the handcraft production, which had been the employment of a large number of people in the off-season, and you reduced peasants to simply working crops, and working crops maybe tied them down 50, 60, 100 days a year, and the rest of the time they simply were idle. So what commodity market did develop only destroyed production, and there was no investment in productivity to take up any slack. We've all heard about how hardworking Chinese peasants are, and indeed, in any job that a Chinese peasant would undertake, the work is tremendously hard. Do you know that the average load on a Chinese wheelbarrow that a man wheels 20 miles a day can be up to half a ton, one man? And if two men are hooked to this wheelbarrow, they can move up to a ton 20 miles a day. You try it sometime. The work is very hard, but the problem was that most people didn't have any such work to do. Most people, fully half or more of the population, had no work to do throughout the winter, and this tremendous potential of human labor was wasted in China before the revolution. And so all these schemes of modernization really only made this situation worse. And what men like Winfield just could not understand was that the problem was one of revolution, of political upheaval, of the change of this whole setup and all these relationships to release the potential forces that were in China. There were hundreds of millions of able-bodied men and women. There were tremendous wealth buried underground. There were, at the time that I worked in China in reclamation of wasteland, there were 300 million acres of wasteland in China that could be reclaimed. And the total crop area of China is only 300 million acres. So there were all of these tremendous resources: labor power, minerals, soil, and so on, but they simply were stagnant because of the feudal land system, the domination of the country by landed gentry, the further domination of the country by imperialism in alliance with landed gentry, which prevented technique from developing, prevented money from being used as capital, and caused it to be buried in the ground. Perhaps you are aware that these sums were enormous. The buried coinage in China was something in the order of $6 billion. And if you know that in India today, there is some equivalent sum buried in the ground in countries which are essentially capital poor. They're borrowing money from the U.S. particularly, but there's hundreds of billions of dollars in gold and silver buried in the ground in a country like India and formerly in a country like China.
WBAI New York.
That was doing nobody any good. So the goal of the revolution was to break up this system and release these productive forces. And strangely, this is the way dialectical process always works. They release productive forces by and prepared the way for socialism by giving every peasant a private piece of land. You couldn't think of, in a certain way, you couldn't think of a more backward step. Here you have hundreds of millions of semi-proletarian and rural proletarian people, propertyless people who are not particularly tied to private property because they've never had any, and have always, many of them, been in this common pool of labor power. And in order to change the society, the first step is to make everyone a little bourgeois. Give everyone a little piece of land, give everyone a bit of a house, give everyone a leg of a mule, at least, and make everyone a bit of a property owner. And this was the first step in the transformation of China, that is the land reform. And land reform was, one could hardly calculate the results on production of this simple step. Simple economically, I mean. It was terribly difficult politically and terribly difficult socially. If anyone is familiar with my book, you'll know it's a 4 to 6 year process just to carry through land reform. But I mean, economically, it's a simple thing. You simply take what a few held and give everyone a share of it, or rather people themselves take what a few held and divide it among them. And to hear it from these American experts, this couldn't possibly do any good. Winfield, for instance, land reform, what's that? Is there going to be any more land when we're done? No. Is there going to be any more capital when it's done? No. Is there going to be any more fertilizer, insecticides, any more science, technique? No. So what good is land reform, says Winfield? You know, we argued this out back in Chungking, 45, I used to argue this out with Winfield. He couldn't see, what on earth is this land reform all about? What are these communists up to? Trying to divide all this property? It's nothing but the distribution of poverty. Well, the question of how can just dividing up these small plots of land change the situation in a huge nation with the largest population in the world and release these productive forces that are latent? Well, it does it in a variety of ways. See, when you have a landlord and you have a tenant, the landlord's only object is to get as much rent as he can, and in a pre-capitalist society, he's not about to invest. He can't invest in production. As I said, he could buy more land, but he could certainly not buy some machinery. First place, someone would probably steal it or steal all the movable parts off it before he even got it home. That's the experience we had taking tractors to China in the Guomindang areas. We couldn't even get them from the seaport to the wasteland, because by the time we got there, the wheels were gone, the spark plugs were gone, the tires were gone, and so on, you know. He couldn't possibly make this kind of investment. All he can do is demand a big rent and make sure that he collects it, and then he cheats in the collection of it. You know. But once the land belongs to the tiller, once the peasant gets his land, then the whole thing changes. He's very anxious to invest in this production, because by putting in some extra effort, he can win an increased return. And this changes the whole attitude. A tenant isn't going to work very hard. He's certainly not going to work to improve anything, because he can't... He may be kicked off the plot next year, and someone else will get the benefit. Or if he improves production, the landlord's only going to take a bigger rent. The tenant is not going to improve things, and the landlord is not going to improve things, so here you have stagnation. But once the land is divided, and everyone gets a relatively equal share, the whole attitude toward production changes, and since what is grown benefits the tiller, all sorts of ideas for improvement, all sorts of investment immediately appear, and things begin to change very rapidly. Among the things that change is that the buried gold and silver comes out of the ground. When you take a landlord that's never done any work, and he's always lived off rents, and you give him an equal share, he gets a couple of acres, and if he's to eat, he has to go and work. One of the first things he does is dig up his gold and silver. And since, under the new democratic laws of China, capital investment was encouraged, he is liable to invest that, either in his farming or in something else. So, on land reform, not only do hundreds of millions of peasants suddenly find it important to increase production, but landlords pull the capital, former landlords pull the capital out of the ground,